Welcome to The Peg Doesn't Fit, the podcast that brings you the change makers in education. Tune in to hear from educational leaders who aren't content with the status quo educational model and are blazing their own path. Welcome to the show, everybody. Today we have Gevor Tully on from San Francisco. I'm going to read his official bio because it's pretty cool. Gevor founded Tinkering School in 2005, one of the earliest camp programs to focus on empowering children in school, children with tools. While the world has focused on stunning images of children building amazing things, he was quietly handing over the running of the camp to the children. Ooh. That collaboration was the inspiration for SF Brightworks, a school that is co-created with the students. I love that. Brightworks explores the world through the ARC pedagogy, a framework for collaborative learning. Along the way, he wrote 50 Dangerous Things You Should Let Your Children Do, launched the Mars program, which brings authentic NASA-inspired rover experiences to classrooms around the world, and is currently piloting Gap Lab, an immersive experience which helps students transitioning from high school, helps them reconnect with their best learning selves. Hello, we have a guest.
Yeah, one of my students. Thank you. Yep.
All right. Well, your bio kind of summarizes how you got to be here, but I don't know that a lot of my listeners will know your whole path. Did you start out as a teacher and you escaped public education or private education? How do you get to be where you are today?
You know, like sometimes I start the origin story in childhood because I grew up in the early 60s and parenting was so different then. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I started in high school because I attended an experimental project-based school inside the California school district system in the late 70s. But, you know, I think my path to education is just the path of a curious individual. And I became fascinated with the change in attitude that we had towards children and their capacity and capabilities. Mm. And you really can chase it back to a catalyzing event, which was a dinner party at my wife's company. And in the course of the dinner conversation, I was like, up on my soapbox complaining about how parents like my age, and in fact, friends that I'd grown up with, weren't letting their children do the kinds of things they had done as children, even though everything about the world is safer compared to the early 60s, you know? And that, like, my close friends were describing our childhood as perfect examples of very poor parenting. And yet I look back to those childhood experiences as, you know, life-shaping seminal events, you know, the forts and fires that my brother and I built unsupervised down on a beach, that, you know, all of these things that seem like normal elements of childhood were now looked back on as those were like absentee parents who did the minimal, you know, and I think that's how those experiences are how children become adults, that agency and autonomy of childhood is really important. And Tinkering School, my summer camp, which is called a school, just to keep things very confusing, Tinkering School was started at this dinner conversation in response to a kind of put up or shut up challenge from my friends at the dinner table. And that really, you know, that really started the whole focus on education as actually this opportunity to redefine childhood and recapture some of that magic of childhood that comes from kids getting a chance to see their ideas through to completion. And whether their ideas is, can we build a fort out of this cardboard box, or can we make lamps and sell them on Etsy? These are all like ideas at different scales that have various kinds of opportunities for the kids to make decisions and live through the ramifications of those decisions. And when we give so much scripted experience to students by predetermining the curriculum and giving them no opportunity to participate in even choices about what we're going to study next, mm-hmm. we take away all of that agency and we make them dependent on other people to make decisions. So, let's say we were trying to make the friendliest possible version of the School of Hard Knocks. You ought to know what it means to overcommit. You ought to know what it means to feel so committed to a project that you're asking the school to open up on the weekends so you can finish. These are all things that happen here at Brightworks quite often. Mm-hmm. The ebb and flow of that commitment and the sense of exhaustion afterwards and the also like accidentally getting caught up again and, getting the ball going again. These are all, I think, parts of the lives of functional adults that we've completely separated from school in the traditional classrooms. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. Does that answer your...
Yeah.
Yeah. Does that... Okay, good. Yeah. Sometimes you ask me a question and I start to think of connected topics.
Sure.
And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm with you there. I do that a lot. So we're at you're approaching almost 20 years of since Tinkering School started. I don't know if I caught, when did you switch over, so to speak, to Brightworks? What year was that?
Right. So Tinkering School has been running continuously since 2005.
Okay.
That was our first summer. Mm-hmm. I mean, we took one summer off when we started Brightworks, and it was just had to do with my level of saturation. Mm-hmm. And there's a generation of Tinkering School participants who will never forgive me for not running Tinkering School that summer. The transition to Brightworks happened because I was talking to students about their lives at school when we were at summer camp together. Mm-hmm. And especially in the early years, the camp was just me and a couple of helpers, and we did everything, and there was too much to do. So we started just having the students help us. And that was the thing I mentioned in my bio was, part of the amazing thing about Tinkering School is that it rests fully on the shoulders now of the kids who've been through it. I mean, mm-hmm. there's a organizational framework that they're working within, but aside from things like COVID, putting a hiccup in the chain of kids rising up through the experience, there's something kind of amazing about really collaborating with, teenagers on the design of the program. Mm-hmm. And then them picking up the reins and being responsible to deliver that designed experience. And, granted, Tinkering School follows a very loose framework that is like from day one, a collaboration with the participants. Mm-hmm. We have a set of materials that are available and that limits certain choices, but within the limitations of those choices, we literally can build anything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that habit that we developed of just opening, like shaping how we open up that question of what shall we build this week? We have a tendency to pick a few like provocative ideas to seed the week with, and then let the conversation come from the work with the students and at the camp. And that's how we end up with, you know, crazy, the Trojan pig. Let's make a giant pig-shaped vehicle that everybody can ride in and we can go over to the castle. And the castle is a stand of trees. I mean, it's if you set out to design the curriculum, you would end up with something like, well, we should build vehicles and we should build, you would end up with these curricular goals that had no correlation to what that group of kids might get excited about. And the fact that Tinkering School still stands out in the kids' minds after all these years as one of those few places in their childhoods where they felt like they had a voice in what was going to happen, not just that day, but that week, is constantly reminding us that kids' lives are scripted by the extrinsic motivations of the adults around them, as if they had no ability to participate in and make decisions about their lives. And I think that's, you know, that's to the deficit of childhood and to the deficit of society, because we end up with kids who graduate high school with no adult decision-making ability. And so their parents have to come to them to their college counselor meetings, or as Google and HP discovered, 15, 20 years ago, they had to inform people at their job interview that they couldn't to get a job post high school, post college. And the fact that an employer might have to, you know, put that reminder in, I think is a very interesting, you know, change in our society.
Yeah, for sure.
So, yeah. So Tinkering School isn't just a summer camp. It's a way to start conversations about childhood autonomy, about kids' capacity to build and work hard, because basically they build dawn to dusk and they would work late into the night if we let them, you know, when we're at camp. And so there's this evidence that when their motivation is intrinsic, kids aren't lazy, kids aren't diminished in their capacity to finish things. They can build, you know, a Ferris wheel and a roller coaster all in the same week with just, you know, 12 of them.
Wow.
And yeah, and it's incredible what they can do when they actually trust that environment enough to share their great idea. And then have a whole bunch of people go, that's the idea, let's do that.
Yeah.
Let's do that. Okay, we're all doing Sylvia's idea, you know.
That's fun.
Yeah. And then the other thing that I think Tinkering School really set us up for, by starting with a camp, and because parents have very low academic expectations about summer camp, not all summer camps, obviously. There's a fantastic math camp that's all physical activities and constructive activities that I wish I'd gone to. I'm not even sure they're still running. It was at Stanford a decade ago, I think. But what I was going to say was the thing that I think most inspired us to start Brightworks and was that collaboration and that notion of collaboration between student and staff at the summer camp. And and we built, that's one of the pillars that we built Brightworks on. We have the ARC pedagogy. We have this notion of fundamentally, foundationally, that the skill of collaboration might be the most valuable thing we could deliver. And all that that entails in terms of their social and emotional development and, mm-hmm. and everything kind of built around that pillar. That's, I think when I really embraced those ideas, that's when the concept of starting a school really formed. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, honestly, that conversation about starting a school was in December of 2004, and we opened the doors in September of 2005.
Wow.
Which I really don't recommend. When people ask me how the school was started, I was like, first off, take more than 10 months. Mm-hmm. It's worth working through the details. But I was so naive. I had no idea even what the legal framework of a school was. And we opened the doors and then retroactively did a lot of paperwork and a lot of communication with the city, and everybody mm-hmm. was like, okay, good, green light, you know, keep going.
Okay.
Yeah. Hmm. But that was a wild ride. The first, I would say, 2 years of Brightworks was just borderline chaos the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sounds like it. What sounds like in a way the Brightworks model looks similar to Tinkering School, in terms of what the school year, so to speak, looks like.
Yeah.
What does a typical day look like for one of your students? And I notice you call your teachers collaborators. Do the students also go by a different name?
Yeah.
Label?
You know, it's interesting. I felt like it was important, especially during the early hiring and interviewing process, to hire people into the position of collaborator. So mm-hmm. in the very first conversation that a teacher might have with us, they would understand, like, we're reframing this role from front of the classroom lecture style to working right alongside.
Yeah.
And the ARC pedagogy means that, like, none of us are experts in a lot of the topics that we take on. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we might have somebody on staff who knows more about geology than we do, but none of us are geologists, for example. So when we took on the salt arc, I needed everybody to understand, like, I don't expect you to be experts in salt. You shouldn't be cramming your heads full of salt knowledge over summer and feeling like you're in this incredible push to become mm-hmm. an expert. What you should be is open-minded and participatory in learning about salt right alongside the kids and bringing your adult ability to sift through the possibilities and curate for the kids what would be great engaging opportunities around salt based mm-hmm. on what you discover with them. So I think the real purpose of the choosing the title collaborator for those positions is to constantly hold in our minds, like, my title now is chief collaborator,
mm-hmm.
you know, is that it, what makes the school work and what creates the best learning experience for the student is to constantly remember that we're working together with them, not for them, not for the school, but with this batch of students together to pull off a school year, you mm-hmm. know? And
so your days kind of, sense. Your days and yeah. years kind of consist of a string of projects, essentially?
So the ARC pedagogy, yeah, each ARC, and that's ARC, like the mm-hmm. narrative ARC,
yep.
right? Because the first thing I started drawing when I started thinking about, and I draw in my notebook when I'm thinking through ideas. And when the first thing I started drawing was some notion of a student-centric education where they were the hero of their own journey, kind of mm-hmm. borrowing that Joseph Campbell idea of the hero's journey. And so that's when I started to think about the narrative of being at school. And if you talk to our students about, you know, what's going on at school this year, I mean, we just moved to a new campus, so that's a big part of the narrative. But mm-hmm. But if you ask them about what's going on, you hear this thing that sounds like it's a little bit like a little kid's story of this happened and then this happened and then this happened. But then you start to realize like, oh, these things actually all tied together, and you can pick at any one of them, you know, or poke at any one of them and ask further questions, and they can, you know, they know all about, you know, freshwater, saltwater environments and the kinds of creatures that need that mix. And, you know, the salt arc was a great, kind of a personal favorite because it highlighted a lot of things, but the every year is divided into a number of arcs, and usually it's three. This year we're trying two because last year we had a conversation as a school about, you know, there's a lot of things about the school we kind of take for granted, and we've been doing three arc years for a number of years, and some of the kids and the staff started a big conversation about maybe this year could be two arcs. And
my boss was trying to walk in.
That's okay.
So you went from three to two.
And there's a kind of like onboarding get together moment at the start of the year that was the first 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. Where, because we're in a new campus and because, you know, we had to change some things to fit into these buildings, we used those first weeks as like community building and also onboarding new students to the project style work that we do. So we do a mini project in those first 4 weeks, and they learn all the steps and stages, and they really experience like how highly we value collaboration and how much we talk about it, and you know, I think it's safe to say kids graduating from BrightWorks are more aware of their own like positive communication habits and their empathy skills than mm-hmm. kids from any other school. But going back to the structure of the arc, the arc itself is divided into three phases. And so that's kind of the three act story of the arc. It starts with a period of exploration mm-hmm. and that's designed as a collaborative survey of the topic for that age group. And our students are divided into groups. They're in near proximity in the ages, but really we're trying to fit that child into a place where they're challenged enough to be interested, but not over-challenged. Okay. So kids might stay with a group for 1 or 2 years as they rise through that mm-hmm. level of intellectual and social engagement. And then the arc is, again, sort of the framework for everything we do in a classroom. And everything ends up getting connected back to the arc topic. So, you know, if we're doing writing, we're doing writing about the topic at hand or about the phase in exploration that we're doing, about the thing we went to see yesterday, the scientist who came in and shared, the chemistry of the ancient oceans because he studies salt. The various, I guess that becomes the the theme of the period of time, and it forms this really reliable touchstone to provoke new activities. Mm-hmm. And while we're doing that research during exploration, while we're all studying this topic, across the school, new opportunities are being shared. And so, you know, a question will come up on Monday, and by Thursday, two or three classrooms are off on a field trip that wasn't scheduled. Our parents sign a year-long field trip release form so that we don't have to get, you know,
one for every single one.
Yeah, exactly. And that simplifies a lot of things. You know, we're located in San Francisco, and so there's a lot of resources in the city that we can get out to that are kind of amazing. The next phase of the arc is called expression. And that's where, during exploration, one of the things the kids have been working on and keeping an eye out for is something that would form the basis of a great project. And so students in groups of one, two, up to four, will be presenting a proposal to the school, something we call the declaration. And the declaration is this kind of, it starts with an elevator pitch, one or two lines that kind of encapsulate the whole idea. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't have that, the kids are like super hand wavy about what their project is. And then an approximate timeline, a list of the resources they need, any safety concerns that they think might be coming up, you know. And because during the salt arc, we did a lot of chemistry projects, and there was, you know, we had to build a fume hood and things like that. Or the students did, in order to get the sign off on their declaration. And the declaration kind of unlocks their project cycle.
Okay.
And so they enter into the, and usually with their declaration, and kind of new this year is the codification of this idea, they have a first prototype, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. You know, if they're going to write a novel, it's a treatment of the first chapter, or, you know, it's the first few pages. It's an outline of the overarching story, you know, that kind of thing. If they were going to build some kind of apparatus, it's a key part of the mechanism done in cardboard or just something to show us that they're essentially their first proof of concept iteration is kind of in the bag, and that's part of their declaration now, that they've worked through a lot of the details and they understand their project. Did you freeze?
Nope. I'm just holding very still.
Yeah. Okay. And the point of that really is so that they understand the upcoming complexities in their project well enough to know how much work they're in for. Like, do they need to recruit another member into their team? Because if we're going to manufacture 40 of these, that's going to take, you know, it takes 2 hours to make one. That's 80 hours of manufacturing time. Where in your schedule do you do that? Mm-hmm. You know, if that's so. And then in the expression phase, they're basically they're doing a mixed schedule of self-directed project work. But the younger they go, the more scaffolding we put around that. And the older they go, the more that relaxes. Mixed in there are various other, you know, curricular efforts on the part of the school. So the mathematical, you know, math, writing, various kinds of related provocations around sciences and physics and things like that, that are just making sure that we're covering some of those breadth issues.
Okay.
Keeping those conversations going. Working on a project means updating your daily progress, checking off your milestones, checking your Kanban, your project management.
Yeah.
Yeah, checking in with your collaborator to make sure, like, this is taking way longer than I thought. So, I need to kill some features, which is one of my, that's one of my favorite conversations, actually, is when kids have to face that, like, hard decision of what am I going to cut out of this in order to make the deadline? Because expression ends at exposition, which is this big sharing moment. It's a week long. It's kind of a celebration of all the effort and everything. Then we kind of clean up and reset the whole school, because during expression phase, we're pretty messy. You know, it's just, it's not, we've never been a tidy, perfectly tidy school. We all spend time every week, like, resetting the building, but at the end of expression phase, kind of a big reset. And then actually usually the Thursday and Friday, like, Thursday is often pajama day and everybody just comes in and lays around and reads and plays cards. And it's like a big, like, rest moment. And then, you know, where we can, we try to schedule it so the end of the arc ends at a break in the school calendar. And then when you come back, we start the next arc. So that's kind of how the year goes. And there's typically there's three in a year. This year we're trying two. It's done some funny things to the calendar, so it's kind of an experiment, which I love, because the students are metacognitive about the school calendar and how things work. And so we can have these really productive conversations with them in very casual, kind of ad hoc ways. It can just be like looking at the upcoming schedule, and the collaborator will say, like, hey, you know, that looks like the arc, you know, the expression phase is going to end, you know, here, and we're not going to be able to go on break. We're going to start, exploration phase is ending. And when we come back from break, there'll have been this huge pause between expression and exploration. And, you know, how do we feel about that? Do we want to kind of sneak or add an extra week of sort of exploration and getting ready, getting our declarations ready at the end of when we first come back? And that's something that a collaborator might just work out with their students. So the school is generally following this calendar. The actual implementation often has a little bit of wiggle in it just because of how things are going. So that's something that I also like, is that how we use our time is an ongoing conversation with everybody who's working on it, in particular the collaborator and the students. And finally, to answer your question, we don't have another name for student. And then, in fact, I kind of feel like we could all use the label student. We should aspire to being students or learners all through our lives, you know. And but I actually, you know, parents who haven't been here for a while, like, it takes a little while for parents to embrace the idea of collaborator instead of teacher, and to really understand what the distinction is. And I feel like if we'd had another name for student, it just would have made the admissions process that much more complicated.
Do you feel like, I think this is kind of a chicken and egg thing, because I do, and it ties into my next question about, is this possible in public education, but or in education, and I'll call it traditional schooling, in general, we have these teachers being trained in colleges in a traditional method, to overgeneralize. Do you hire teachers that, as your collaborators, that have a tradition in education, or are you kind of open to whatever? And if you do hire, I'll say, classically trained educators, do they have a little bit of a transitional struggle time as well?
Oh, for sure. there's a, I wouldn't call it necessarily a struggle, but it's an adaptation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things that, that often comes up in conversation in interviews with potential candidates or with teachers after they've hired is a growing realization that, you know, without grades and without tests, we rely on a different set of expectations in order to be rigorous about what we're doing.
Yeah.
And those expectations are not always, they're not always easy to measure, right? Mm-hmm. Like we have some rubrics that help set the conversations, and the kids and the collaborators fill out the rubric together, you know? And so in that sense, the rubric is really a conversation framework for mm-hmm. talking about where that student sees their potential for growth and where they think challenges lay going forward. Like, I'm still struggling to be excited about writing is a very much more interesting conversation than saying your grammar score is very low or your spelling right. is terrible, right? Mm-hmm. If the conversation instead is about motivation and about, you know, fostering an actual interest in getting better at writing so that writing becomes more interesting to you, then, you know, that's a conversation you can really have with another person. I don't care if it's a student to teacher conversation or it's two people talking over coffee. Like, mm-hmm. you know, you might be talking with a friend and saying, like, the biggest challenge of my new job is all the writing. I've never been a great writer. And, you know, I'm not sure I love writing enough to do this job. Learning how to look at your own learning is part of being here.
Yeah.
So learning isn't something magical about, you know, this just happens because we pour all this curriculum on you and enough of it sticks mm-hmm. that you become a graduate, right?
Right.
I think the other part of that sort of that whole question of where do our teachers come from or where do our collaborators come from is, yeah, we hire teachers because if you meet them at a point in their lives where they're not jaded and
oh, that was the word
out,
I was going to use. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that's a real thing.
There right? is a point at which you give up fighting the system. I think many teachers enter very inspired to change the world, so to speak, in their own classrooms. Yeah. And then slowly the system kind of beats them down and they do become yeah. jaded.
I have a solution for this.
Ooh.
If I ever become Secretary of Education for the mm-hmm. United States or, you know, King of the world or something,
yes.
I think that we need to move away from looking for a single solution.
Mm-hmm.
There almost can't be a single curricular framework that works for all students in all situations with that combination of teachers that you can hire in that school district, right? And instead, every school district, and there's a school district up in Spokane that I'm really interested in because they're actually implementing this. They have a project-based program inside the public school district.
Ooh, segue.
Running in parallel. Yeah. And which, if I can remember the name of the project, I have it in my notebook.
Okay.
But what I mean to say is, I think that every school district should have one or two alternative programs running inside as part of a kind of renaissance effort mm-hmm. to develop and share new frameworks for teaching that are more effective for different populations. You know,
yeah.
if you're in a school district where more than 50% of your kids are coming from violence and trauma
mm-hmm.
and they're they're having trouble focusing on a textbook, the answer is not to ignore them or to throw them into summer school where there's more textbooks.
Right.
Right. We ought to have something that is more approachable for that population. Likewise, if you have parents and families who aren't sending their schools into the public school, well, that's feedback that the program that's there is not attractive to families who are uncomfortable with, top-down hierarchy of decision-making that doesn't treat their student, their child as a person, right? So I really think the renaissance in education comes from deliberately funding variation in order to try thousands of different things and to put frameworks in place for sharing successes and challenges so that, district-wide and within state to state, best practices are being shared.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of that, I think we're measuring the wrong things when we measure the students the way we do now. So,
yes.
Right.
We're not measuring too many skills. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And the things that we are measuring is, it's causing a lot of health problems, mental health problems, mm-hmm. physical health problems. It's destroying the social fabric at school. I really feel like, the first thing we have to do is change what and how we test. But that's
what, maybe that, I love that answer. Oh, of course. Yes. Maybe for a round two someday. Where do you see Brightworks long-term? Have you arrived as it is, or are you going to franchise this idea out everywhere, or what does this look like in the future?
We're a very open source kind of school.
Oh, my favorite word.
Educators can come and learn everything and anything about how we run it. We've helped other people. We don't need a franchise of Brightworks, around the world. I think that Brightworks is a place where people come, educators come and take some things that really resonate for them and mix it with some of their own ideas. And then you get, because you get the positive support from us, I often end up in Zoom calls just with educators after they visited and they reveal, I've been thinking about starting a school and I have my eye on a building and I'm like, mm-hmm. great, start with the building, get your insurance arranged. I'm like what I did. And then, try it, because in every one of those situations, often what they needed was just a positive we froze for a second.
I heard the last word I heard was positive.
Oh, sometimes they just need a positive support framework to empower them to try the idea they've really been thinking about. And the framework from Brightworks sometimes gives them a place to start, and then they'll make a variation that's their own. Right.
I love it.
Yeah. And I don't think there's anything magical about the Brightworks pedagogy.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's a very interesting pedagogy and that it does some things that other frameworks don't do, and it does them very well.
Mm-hmm.
It also has its challenges, training for one, how do you get good? You work at it for about 3 years and then you're really a Brightworks educator.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm. Thank you. I like that.
Yeah.
We'll wrap up here. So a couple questions about, what keeps you inspired and all of that, and where to follow you, Brightworks if they want to. So let's start with what things keep your learning fresh or your following certain people, blogs, videos, or schools, yeah, or whatever that is to keep your development going, lifelong learning.
I was just looking to see if I had the note for the name.
Oh, if you do, I want it.
Of the program. And, oh, On Track. Yeah.
On Track. That's the Spokane.
That's the one in Spokane.
Okay.
Yeah. It was on page 2 of my notes. My notes are a little bit stream of consciousness.
I like it. Lots of work in there.
Yeah. So if you want to follow kind of what's going on actively, what I'm thinking about, you can find me on Instagram as @GaberTully.
Okay.
If you want to see what's happening at the school, at SF Brightworks on Instagram, shares curated postings from the various age groups here.
Okay.
Which those ones are all locked. Like only the parents can see, the parents and the administration get in there.
Mm-hmm.
But then curated posts come up out. And so that's a good way to kind of get a glimpse.
Yeah.
There are a lot of educators that I pay attention to, people who I think are thinking about really interesting things. Mm-hmm. You know, my hero, of course, is Seymour Papert, and he passed away, you know, a decade ago. It's the great tragedy of my life that I missed an opportunity to actually meet him.
Mm-hmm.
The people that I follow tend to fall into two camps.
Okay.
Child advocates and child agency. So, America's Worst Mom, Lenore Skenazy. She has an Instagram and Twitter that are just amazing. She fights. I met her after I wrote 50 Dangerous Things
mm-hmm.
that You Should Let Your Children Do. And she fights for the rights of children to do normal activities and
mm-hmm.
to make it legal for parents to let their kids play unsupervised in their front yard. And
yeah.
she's just a champion for children. Educator wise, I often find myself looking at the work of early educators because that's where there's a lot of freedom to explore hands-on experiential education.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, I'm always asking people like, where's the Montessori college? You know, like why do we abandon Reggio practices in middle school? And then we have this other arbitrary framework that we adopt for mm-hmm. high school that isn't based on anything. You know,
right.
Like what? Yeah. You know, where's Reggio University? But in particular, the one who really stands out lately is the work of teacher Tom. He has a blog and Instagram feed. He's just Teacher Tom. And if you search for that, Teacher Tom and mm-hmm. early education, his blog is amazingly well-written. And is really well linked. So when he's mm-hmm. talking about research, all the links are there. And he's a great thinker about early childhood. And what it turns out is that that framework of learning with our hands and learning by doing actually applies through all ages. And we abandon it, you know, after early elementary for no good reason. And that's why Seymour Papert started lifelong kindergarten at MIT, which, you know,
lifelong, that's the writing it down, lifelong
kindergarten. Yeah.
You're the second person in recent, well, actually Alec Resnick from last week was on my show. And he also cited Seymour Papert. And so I better do my own due diligence now. check him out.
Every time I think I invented something, I find out that Seymour was there first.
Okay. Well, I guess you're standing on the shoulders of giants then, whether directly or not. That's exciting to find. I'm sure that feels validating in some sense too. Like, oh my gosh, somebody
for sure.
Somebody felt this and it's my hero.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. And
thanks for having me, Ryan.
I really appreciate it.
I look forward to further conversations.
Thank you.